He spent over two decades in the wrestling business, was able to see all the greats of the game firsthand, no doubt has plenty of great stories, as his book attests. I can only be speaking of the one and only Gary Michael Capetta, who we welcome to the FDH Lounge. Gary, welcome to the program, sir.
Hello there.
Hi, pleasure to have you on, Gary. I want to start on a sad but newsworthy note here. I think the headlines of today demand that I start by asking you about this. You were a longtime colleague of Captain Lou Albano. Sadly enough, his passing today, I guess he'd been in hospice the last couple of days, so there had been reports. We kind of saw this coming, but still sad whenever it does happen. Please add to whatever knowledge you can give as far as any Captain Lou Albano stories, your experiences with the man, anything you'd care to say.
Well, first off, this is the first I'm hearing of it.
Oh.
So I'm very very sad to hear about the passing of Captain Lou. Wow. I'm a little shocked, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hit you with that on the air. Yeah, that hit a little bit earlier today. Came over the transom and... you know, were you aware that he'd been in declining health recently?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was. The last I had seen Captain was at the book party for my book.
Okay.
Where he came to what I did was I brought my book to life. I brought in several of the wrestling personalities who were instrumental in my career, and we came together, and 500 people showed up, and I interviewed them. It was a benefit for Cancer Institute in Philadelphia, and Lou was there to help us out, and I'm really sorry to hear about his passing.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry about the circumstances with you finding out this way. I'm glad to get your thoughts on the man. And yeah, it is a sad day.
He had a huge heart. You know, he was obviously everybody knows he was a colorful character, one of the cornerstones of one of the three cornerstones of managers back in the 60s and the 70s. He started as one of the Sicilians with Tony Altimore as a tag team wrestler. And upon his retirement from the ring and wrestling, went on to manage many, many superstars. Was instrumental in bringing Cindy Lauper into the rock and wrestling era in the 1980s. He was on a flight to Puerto Rico, and Cindy Lauper was a wrestling fan. She was on the same flight, and it was through the meeting of those two on that one flight to Puerto Rico where Cindy Lauper joined the WWF at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much changed the history of wrestling and the outlook with Hulk Hogan, Hulkamania. And Cindy had come in to manage the ladies' champion, but it was all Lou Albano's doing. So no, I'm really sorry to hear about his passing.
Yeah, it's one of those chance meetings that really can change the course of history sometimes, or even in an industry, as it did, playing into the whole rock and wrestling connection of the time, which actually is a pretty good segue to something I wanted to ask you about, because in the course of doing some research for this interview and going through some of your past statements, I found it to be very interesting that you cited among your professional influences Jimmy Lennon. And that's, I thought that was kind of apropos, because it always struck me as somebody who watched you, you always sort of came across to me more as a boxing style announcer, more sports than sports entertainment, essentially in that sense. So because of, you know, you ended up leaving the WWF for issues that you alluded to with your book, as far as, you know, any personal issues with Vince or whatever. But did you feel that the fact that your style was more of a legitimate sports style, and they were starting to go in the cartoon direction in the mid '80s? Do you feel that stylistic differences would have come between you if professional differences and personal ones hadn't?
No, not at all.
Okay.
If you look at the video history of my career, my announcing style changed through the years.
Okay.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, that is how I started. I was with the WWW and then WWF for 11 years. When I left to start the first pro wrestling show on ESPN with Vern Gagne. And he had a difficult time with melding pro wrestling to that very serious sports style of that network. But he asked me at one point when we were taping in Atlantic City to he wanted a more lively style. Mm-hmm. So anyone that looks back at those tapes of when I was with the AWA on ESPN, it was a more boisterous style. And then it became more toned down when I went to the NWA, and it was more serious kick butt wrestling, I guess we should say.
Mm-hmm.
And then on to the WCW. So it went from very, very dry to over-dramatic, and then somewhere in between toward the end of my announcing career.
Interesting, yeah, because I don't think I saw as much of the AWA stuff. My primary memories of you would be from the NWA WCW time, and I didn't grow up in a part of the country that got the WWF or WWWF when you were with them, when it was largely a regional production. But what was that like being with them in that stage? I mean, it was just the northeastern part of the country. So talk about, you know, how the business changed from your personal perspective in terms of when you came in, you're with this regional thing to towards the end there in WCW. You must have been going all over the place all the time.
Well, when I started, it was purely by accident. I had absolutely no training in. Never had a communications course, never had a speech course, never had a broadcasting course, never studied for announcing. There came a time, I was a fan, and there came a time when I was at the show. It was a different era, which never happened today, but they didn't have an announcer, and I volunteered. Mm-hmm. And they liked what they heard. This was not Vince McMahon, because at the time, Vince McMahon Sr. Mm-hmm. owned the majority of the stock in the company, and Gorilla Monsoon was the next largest stockholder, and it was one of his shows. And he was each of the stockholders had a different part of the territory, and Monsoon had New Jersey, Eastern Pennsylvania, and Delaware. I was residing in New Jersey. This was where it happened, and they liked what I did, and at the end of the night, they asked me if I had any experience, and I lied to them and said, yeah, sure. And they said, well, come back next week and wear a tie, and we'll put you in the ring. And it was a weekly wrestling show down at the shore. And at the end of the summer, I began teaching. I had just graduated from college, and Monsoon called me and asked me if I wanted to continue working with him. So I did, not even realizing that he was the producer of the WWF TV show.
Okay.
And after working with him for 2 years and learning the craft, he put me on television.
Interesting.
So that's how that started.
And I've seen some other stories in the history of the business of where people got in more or less by accident. Some people have the grand design. Some people, it just happens to be fate and a chance meeting and everything. And
there was no design here. It's just by chance.
Well, a previous guest on our show, J.J. Dillon, I know that from what he said on the show and what he said in his book, it was almost a chance thing on his part. You know, Johnny Valentine happened to make his acquaintance and everything. So it's interesting that you fall onto that side of it, of people who, again, for lack of a better word, fate kind of led you into the business. Something I'd like to ask about as far as any observations that you may have. It's interesting that when you went from the WWF, I know it was eventually to the AWA, but initially, I know you were doing the Pro Wrestling USA shows, which were, you know, kind of a hybrid AWA, NWA, a couple different other territories involved in there. We hear subsequently, and again, some of this is on history, you know, from the, you know, the WWE produced DVDs, and of course, the winner writes the history, blah, 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 but it is out there, corroborated by a fair number of people as far as the discord between the different promotions. We know that Pro Wrestling USA eventually splintered and came apart, a lust for control, I guess, by different factions here. How much of that did you ever sense when you were there as far as this thing being doomed as a long-term coalition?
Well, when Vince Jr. began to expand his operations into the other territories, the other promoters laughed at him, thought there was no way that this kid's ever going to make anything of himself. He's going to fall on his face. And Vern Gagne, who I had known from working through the AWA, his local representative was Gary Jester, who also worked, and so he was a local promoter, behind-the-scenes promoter. He also worked with the Crockett family, the NWA. And so when Pro Wrestling USA came about, Gary Jester was their representative. And he didn't want me to work with them because I was so closely aligned with the WWF for so many years that they wanted to put together a product that was very, very different from the McMahon product. But it just so happened that he had met me, and we hit it off, and I started working with him. So that's how, that was the evolution from AWA, Pro Wrestling USA, to the Crockett's. I did several of the Great American Bashes for a few summers, and then Crockett sold to Ted Turner, and that's when I joined WCW full-time in 1989. There was discord, to get to the answer to your question, but the other promoters thought that there was nobody that could ever come in and take them over in their own towns because they had ruled for so long. But what they didn't realize was, and this is not to say that there was anything wrong with their product, that they didn't have great wrestling in Charlotte and Atlanta or Minneapolis and Chicago for the AWA, but they never had competition, and they didn't know how to compete. And by the time they realized that McMahon would be a serious threat, it was too late. He had come in, and he had taken their key personnel. He had started taking the key arenas. He had started to take some key television stations and TV slots from them. So they pretty much did themselves in by never having to be innovative in the past. Whatever wrestling product they put out for Vern Gagne in Minneapolis, for instance, and Atlanta and Charlotte for the Crockett's, whatever they put out, the fans were there, but there was only one product in town. So they never had to worry about anyone else. And once again, it's not to say that their wrestling product wasn't good, but it was just a whole different game when McMahon came into town. So, yeah, I was in the middle of all of that. In fact, I hold this distinction of working for the WWF, the AWA, and the NWA. I'm the only person who ever did that, like, all at one time.
Wow. That is...
It was, didn't last long.
Yeah. Well, even to juggle that briefly, I mean, that's quite a historical footnote. I mean, and I'm one of these guys, too, and especially the way things are today, you know, I'm not super enamored of the product today, but I'm one of these people who always finds, you know, the intrigue and the politics of the business to almost be more fascinating than what goes on in the ring. So it's great to hear that, and I know that a lot of other listeners are, you know, intrigued to hear your thoughts on it as well. Of course, as we said, these are thoughts that can be found in your book, Body Slam's Memoirs of a Wrestling Pitchman. But the other thing is, too, as we talk about your career, I know that there's so much stuff that's out there. There are some different forums that you've also had for disseminating things about your career. It's kind of a coincidence, actually, that our producer, Steve Servillo, bumped into you at the one-man show for Johnny Valiant, because it's something that you've been working on yourself, as well as a screenplay and some other projects. So talk about how you've been able to draw upon your experiences and be able to put that out there in a creative way for people.
Well, when the original Body Slams book came out, before it was picked up by ECW Press, an ECW Press edition is an expanded edition of my original book. Back in the day, it was before Mick Foley's first book came out, and I had great difficulty in selling the book to publishers who had a very antiquated idea of what a wrestling fan was, believed that wrestling fans didn't read, and so I self-published the book. And in doing so, I did everything that I could think of to promote the book as one person spearheading the project. A couple of things that I did was, in writing the book, there's a lot of quotes and of different stories, like the night that Sid and Arn had their knife fight in England, the night that Mick Foley lost his ear. And one of the things that I enjoyed in writing the original edition was I can get into their heads and I could recreate the verbiage and what they were saying. And I thought that was the easiest part of writing this book. So when I finished writing the book, I went right into writing a screenplay, which is called Fall for the Dream. It's based on my book, but I give my experiences to a young up-and-coming wrestler who witnesses a lot of the things that I did. So the screenplay was one thing that came from the original book. And the other was I wrote a one-man stage production with video and music. I performed it in a university in Virginia and then at the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame back about 4 or 5 years ago. And I always had wanted to see the Johnny Valiant show, and I never had gotten to see it, so I went into New York a few weeks ago, which is where I met your representative there,
mm-hmm.
and I may be bringing my stage show to New York as a result of a couple of meetings that I've had since then.
Oh, excellent.
So we will see that. If that happens, it'll happen in 2010.
Oh, that's great. That's great. You know, and you talked about having performed at the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, and that leads me to a question too, as far as a number of these creative projects, but specifically that stage show and the fact that I'm sure that show was something that some of your peers were probably there to see when you performed it there. What kind of feedback have you gotten from your peers, the folks who are on the road with you or perhaps were in different promotions but were in the business? Have you been able to get valuable feedback from them as you've been developing these projects?
Well, when when the book was picked up by ECW Press, I wanted to update it and go beyond the original Body Slams book. I talked about the difficulty in publishing the original book. I talked about independent wrestling as I found it. After the book came out, I started working for Ring of Honor as a backstage interviewer, so I share some stories about that. And in addition, I think this might be a first, too. I'm not sure, but I went to several of the wrestling personalities that I talked about in my book, especially those that I talked about in a negative light, and I offered them an opportunity to respond to me. So my current book, Body Slams, toward the end of the book, there are people like Mick Foley and Jim Cornette who, and they're unfiltered, unedited. I didn't even respond to what they said. I gave them an opportunity to talk back to me. So you'll read the book, and it is in time order of my career. And then at the end, I'm almost like an appendix. You'll read about what Mick Foley thought about what I said and what my comments were, what my observations were, Jim Cornette and so forth. So that was fun. And it's something that a reader will get a whole different perspective on my original stories and comments.
Well, you probably just sold a whole lot of books by mentioning that, because it's rare for somebody to do that. It's going to be tantalizing to think what they would have written in there, what their thoughts would have been. By the same token, a very honorable thing to do on your part, because there are a number of people that have been in the business who I respect very much, but who have used their books to perpetrate I don't want to say to perpetrate grudges against one another exactly, but who have exposed, you know, grievances that they've had with folks and gone back and forth. You know, Foley and Flair come to mind as far as the tete-a-tete that, you know, between their books. That's very admirable on your part that you gave people a chance to respond like that.
Well, an author has total control. Control of the story, whether it be true or not, control of how much of what is said, and simply control of what's put in there to begin with and what's left out.
Mm-hmm.
So the body slams is very different because my perspective is different from that of a wrestler's. It's one of the reasons that when people read it, I think it's easy for them to put themselves in my shoes. And I always have kept one foot in wrestling, in the wrestling world, and one foot outside the wrestling world.
Mm-hmm.
So that perspective, and I think a more honest evaluation of what goes on in wrestling is represented in my Body Slams book.
Well, you do come across certainly as a very well-rounded individual with all the interests that you have here, and I know that additionally, this was a biographical note that we had that you are involved with the Italian Culture Society, and something else that I find to be very interesting as well, and this is something where I have to give credit, as I mentioned earlier on, our show is being live blogged tonight at googlingatleehammaker.blogspot.com. I have to give credit to the moderator there, Platinum Smalls, for mentioning this. This is something I hadn't even come across before. I was not aware that you co-authored with Bert Sugar the Complete Idiot's Guide to Pro Wrestling. So that's another feather in your cap.
That's not accurate.
Oh, then, oh, okay.
I think Captain Lou did.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I read, okay. Big faux pas on my part. You know what?
That's okay.
He was talking about Captain Lou Albano here. Okay. I can't even blame that on him. That's my bad as I'm, yeah, because he had some bio info about Lou Albano earlier here. Okay, all right. So I credited you with something you didn't do, but
that's quite all right.
you do have many projects, as I said, to your credit, and we always like to give our guests a chance to plug. We've got a bunch of them out. Oh, there is one other one that he mentioned that. I will double check this to make sure that this one. Okay, I'm specifically seeing Gary Michael Capetta here, so this is safe for me to mention. Gary Michael Capetta was the ring announcer for the video game Showdown: Legends of Wrestling. So you were involved with that as well.
I did that. The most recent was I did a voice in the movie The Wrestler,
mm-hmm.
And that was fun too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was such a great movie. What was that like to be a part of? That had to be so special to be a part of.
Well, I was very separate from the acting unit.
Okay.
I went in on the day to the director, Darren Aronofsky's office, and I did a bunch of announcements for them. Announcements that appear in the very beginning of the film underneath the credits. I have never seen it, but this is what I've been told.
Oh, it's an amazing piece of work. We had on Robert Siegel on the show a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about what it was like to write for that. And I know
I've seen the movie.
Yeah,
but I got to the theater late.
Okay,
so I never saw what I did.
Okay.
It's just weird.
start to finish, it was awesome. One of the things that was amazing early on in the credits was. And this just shows you the detailed attention. And I say this as somebody who grew up on the After Mags. They had a montage in there in the beginning. Some were wrestling posters and whatever, and some were were After Mags that they had in there, you know, and Interview 87, you know, Randy the Ram, I'm coming to take the world title. You know, just the fact that they were faking those things in there. It was great, and I can see why they would have had you involved in there, because you've been such a part of the fabric of the business over time. And I think it's a thing where, as I say, you know, some of the best memories I had from when I was younger from watching this were time period when you were involved with WCW back in the day. I mean, have you ever had the itch to where if circumstances changed or if somebody were able to sprout up as a legitimate contender to Vince of where you might entertain going back?
That's very unlikely.
Okay.
It's very unlikely because I'm very happy with my life as it is, and for me to be lured back into wrestling full time, it would have to be very secure, very worthwhile. It's just not a description that fits wrestling. And I would doubt it. The two things that we've already mentioned that I would pursue, which would not force me to leave what I'm doing now, would be the stage show and the movie. Those two things I would really like to get further mileage out of.
Okay.
And it's just interesting, when I went in and I met Darren Aronofsky, the director of the movie, he told me that he used body slams as one of his reference points when writing the movie. So I thought that was pretty neat.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, to have been a part of the inspiration in any way for that is something I'm sure that you will always treasure. But, you know, it's been a great career that you've had, Gary. I look forward to seeing what happens here with the stage show, the screenplay, as these projects continue to evolve. And as you continue to take these steps forward, we would certainly love to have you back on the show sometime, sir.
I would love it. It's been fun. I appreciate you asking me.
Well, it was great to have you on. You're somebody with a lot to offer as far as interesting stories and everything you were there for. You're certainly one of the greats of the game as far as being a ring announcer. We enjoyed it greatly. We will look forward to doing it again. Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you.
All right, Gary Michael Capetta, everybody, the one and only joining us here.